Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Kansas City Public Library. I'm Katie Stover, the Director of Reader Services. I want to thank you all for attending tonight's event because it's the signature event in our summer reading program, Dare to Discover. And now I want to talk a little bit about our program, because if the title of tonight's program had you thinking about music, we'd understand. Because in addition to contributing to Vice, Rhizome, The Guardian, and Wired, and finding time to advise graduate design students at the Art Center College of Design in California, Claire Evans is the founder of the electro-pop punk band Yacht. Yacht. Please do not confuse this band with Yacht Rockers, Loggins, Messina, Cross, or the Eagles. While listening to some yacht music this afternoon, though, I was reading about the band's philosophy. I started to think about the internet. And we think it's a stopping place, but it really isn't. We're constantly moving on it. And I know, info superhighway, blah, blah, blah. But I took a moment to think about the internet the way I think about music, how both are in perpetual motion. And I thought about Yacht, the band's quest as movement, not a resting point, and immediately zeroed in on the book Broadband while I was reading about the band. And I started to think about technology, and people, and creativity, and connection, and who and what it took to get here. And I think there are far more similarities between Claire's band, Yacht, and a library than we're all aware of. And if, as Claire believes, science is a kind of poetry, then you can't have either without people. And that includes the women people, too. So here to speak to us tonight about the women who made the internet, please welcome Claire Evans.
Thank you so much for those kind words. Hi, I'm Claire. I'm so excited to be here in Kansas City. I've actually never visited before, so I'm extra doubly delighted. One of the great things about being an author is that sometimes you get to go places that you wouldn't necessarily have a chance to go. So I'm so grateful to be here, and I'm so grateful for this beautiful library for bringing me out. I'm gonna talk to you tonight, yes, about women, yes, about computers, preferably together, because it turns out they play really well together. This is me and my Steve Jobs ensemble, so you can tell that I'm an authority on the subject. All it takes is a mock turtleneck, as it turns out. So, like a lot of people of my generation, I guess I qualify as a millennial, maybe, I've always been really, really fascinated by computers. In fact, they've always been a huge part of my life. I grew up on the computer, essentially. And my father worked for Intel, the computer chip manufacturer, so we always had computers in the house as long as I can remember. And I never felt growing up that computers were for boys or for girls any more than I thought like the toaster or the television was for boys or for girls. It was just an appliance that happened to open up a lot of doors for me, but an appliance nonetheless. I was so obsessed with my home computer as a kid that I made my father film me beat the CD-ROM game Myst. Is anyone familiar with this game? It was an incredibly tedious, fussy CD-ROM game with only really just clicking through worlds in order to beat it, but I was so obsessed with just computer games and being on the computer that I made my father document me really quite well, as you can tell, beating this very challenging computer game. And I loved this game, and I loved games in general because I felt like they opened up a new reality for me. And when the internet came along and became a part of my life, when the World Wide Web showed up on the scene, I felt the same way about that. I felt like it was a portal to this other dimension, this other reality, a place where I could be free and discover and learn and become myself. But something happened in the intervening years between this and this. I began to feel like somewhat out of step with tech. I think something happened to tech too, not just to me. My computer, which I had so previously loved, which had always felt like my domain, my country, kind of stopped feeling like it was my country. Stopped feeling hospitable to me as a human being, but also as a woman, mostly as a woman. And I started to feel like I was a stranger in my own land, if you will. So a few years ago, I began to ask myself, well, had the computer ever been my country, or was I just deluded as a child? So in many ways, my book began from that question. Had computers ever been my country? I suppose I was looking for, or rather I really needed, to find a lineage of people that might include somebody like me, a lineage that could validate my childhood certainties. So I spent 2.5 years, 3 years, talking to women in tech, researching the history of women in tech, talking to so many fantastic, fascinating older women about their experiences, you know, at the dawn of the World Wide Web or the dawn of the internet itself. And in doing this, I found the lineage I was looking for. I found the tech mothers and grandmothers that we can all emulate. But I also found something different, something that I hadn't expected, something in many ways more interesting to me. And that is, I found the seeds of a completely different future, a possibility. But before I get too deep into that, I want to go back to the beginning of the history. So women and technology go all the way back to women weaving around the looms together from the beginning of time. But we have to start somewhere, so let's start, in this case, in 1892. We'll get through this in 45 minutes, no problem. So say it's 1892, okay, bear with me. And say that we live in New York City. For some context, in January of that year, an immigration processing center called Ellis Island opened. And in March, in Springfield, Massachusetts, the first ever game of basketball was played, invented by this man, who was a YMCA instructor, really desperate to keep a bunch of stir-crazy young kids entertained indoors. But the winter is over now, and it's the 1st of May, okay? So just shy of summer, just shy of the 20th century. It's before the screen, it's before the mouse, it's before the pixel, before the byte. But there's a strange notice in the classified pages of the New York Times on May 1st, 1892. This is the first instance of the word computer in print. And it wasn't placed by a time traveler, of course. The person who placed this ad wasn't looking for a computer to buy, they were looking for a computer to hire. Because for close to 200 years, a computer was not a thing, it was a job, as in someone who computes, who performs computations for a living. Same thing can be said for the word calculator, by the way. So say you decided to answer that want ad. You want a job as a computer. Well, first thing, you have to take a math test. And if you pass that test, then you would probably be seated at a long table, something like this, with lots of other people. And together, you would all work together on complicated, large-scale math problems, problems too large for any single individual to tackle alone. Using pen and paper, you would, as a group, advance astronomy, maritime navigation, pure mathematics, ballistics, any number of computationally intensive mathematical jobs. You would form the sort of physical infrastructure of the emerging scientific age. You would be, both as individuals and as a network, the computational infrastructure of science in the 19th and early 20th century. You would embody it. You would make science possible. Computing offices like these were like thinking factories. So the 19th century British mathematician Charles Babbage, who was an important figure in this history, he called what human computers did mental labor. And that's a pretty good way to think about it. It was just work that didn't, well, the prevailing idea anyway, was work that it didn't require intellectual talent or sophistication. It was just work that you did with your mind. You know, the same way that we hammer a nail with our arms, this was mental labor. But of course, human computers did a great deal. They helped launch the US space program by making trajectory calculations. At NASA, they assisted in studies of nuclear fission on the Manhattan Project. They crunched astronomical data, literally charted the cosmos, at Harvard. They cracked World War II codes at Bletchley Park. The applications of human computing were as diverse as the applications of any mathematical project. These people tackled a whole lot of different problems. But they did have one thing in common, which I imagine you can guess by now. Yeah, the human computers were all primarily women. In fact, computing was considered so much of a woman's job that by the time mechanical computers came along, largely independently actually, from their human counterparts, mathematicians would actually measure how long it took for a computer to process problems by describing it in terms of girl years. Or they would describe units of machine labor as being equivalent to one or more kilo girls. Okay, so that's how like intrinsic these histories are. Women were computers to this level. But of course, women doing this kind of work were always paid less than the few men who did the same. So in the late 19th century, the astronomer Edward Charles Pickering, he needed an arsenal of human computers to analyze and classify stellar spectrum data at his lab at Harvard, and he hired only women. He didn't do that. In fact, including his own maid, Wilhelmina Fleming. And he didn't hire Wilhelmina Fleming and a bunch of other women because he had some inherent respect for the female mind or because he wanted to give them opportunities in this life. He did it because he had tons of data and he needed a lot of people, and by hiring women, he could get twice as many people for the same job because they were paid half as much. But the Harvard computers, which are sometimes known to history as Pickering's harem, they cataloged 10,000 stars. Wilhelmina Fleming, the maid, discovered the Horsehead Nebula, and her colleague, Annie Jump Cannon, who has the coolest name in the history of science, she could classify stellar spectrum data at a rate of 3 stars a minute. They mapped the cosmos, and we still use that data. But their wages were equivalent to those of unskilled workers. So they were paid between 25 and 50 cents an hour, which was only a little bit more than factory workers. And maybe women working on this kind of thing might have been a novelty at the age of Pickering's harem, but things change, especially during wartime. So major wars have always had an unmistakable effect on gender and work. The Civil War brought huge numbers of women into the workforce, primarily battlefield widows. And of course, the First and Second World Wars ushered thousands of women into the workplace, most famously as mechanics, but also as typists and clerks and telephone operators, mostly telephone operators. In fact, telephone companies were the first mass employers of a female workforce. In 1891, about 8,000 women worked for the telephone companies, and by 1946, nearly 250,000. I tell you about this because, again, this is an example of female bodies and minds forming the underlying technological infrastructure of an emerging sort of techno-scientific era. Again, they were embodying the technology by making the physical connections. By the early 20th century, women were everywhere. They were staffing switching boards, they were keeping records, they were taking dictation, they were doing all these office tasks that are now performed by digital assistants and bots and automated systems, and of course, artificial intelligences like Siri and Alexa, many of which still speak in the default with female voices. As for the human computers, they began to disappear around the 1940s, although in some domains, most significantly in aeronautics, which of course is illustrated most beautifully in Hidden Figures, the book and the film, you know, important calculations continued to be done by hand by talented human computers well into the 1970s, which is when NASA formally dissolved its human computing divisions. And that's because lives were at stake. Now, a lot of these human computers, including the women at NASA, found work programming the machines that ostensibly replaced them, the mechanical computers that emerged from the spike in computer science research during World War II. Now, these computers were developed in secret during the war to crunch numbers that were necessary to the war effort, namely ballistics trajectories. And the first people to hire to operate those machines, well, they were the women who were already doing those exact same calculations by hand. And because software wasn't seen as anything important, really, no more important than patching cables, like a telephone operator, or handling paperwork like a secretary, or doing math like a computer, programming was a job that was given by default to women, who accepted it gladly, because here was something that they could do with their mathematical aptitudes that wasn't just becoming a secretary or a typist or a teacher. Except, of course, that operating these new mechanical computers was not exactly a simple proposition. These were the first machines of their kind in the world. There was no instruction manual. There was no tech support. You know, there was no like friendly library tech support to show you how to use this stuff. There was just the machine. And these women, when they came on, had to put math on this unknowable, new, surreal box. When the mathematician Grace Hopper, quite famous in this history, of course, was first assigned to program the Harvard Mark I computer in 1944, she had to basically reverse engineer the machine that she'd been assigned to because she had no idea what to do with it. She had to study wiring diagrams and take components apart and bug all the hardware engineers that were still hanging around to ask them how this machine worked until she finally got to a point where she understood it as well as, if not better than, frankly, than a lot of the hardware engineers. The same thing is true for the 6 women who were assigned to the first all-electronic programmable computer, the ENIAC, by the US Army during the war. And when I say programming, I mean, we think about programming today as, you know, you sit down at a screen and you bang code away on a keyboard, but this is programming at the machine level. So these women, you can even see in this picture, were quite literally crawling around inside this room-sized machine, manually patching cables, replacing burned-out vacuum tubes, wiring control boards, very physically interfacing this massive machine. And by the time they were finished putting programs on the machine in this way, the ENIAC could run differential calculus equations in seconds. But their job was officially qualified as sub-professional, with, of course, the pay difference to reflect that. And when the ENIAC was unveiled to the public and the press after the war in 1946, these women were never introduced. In fact, although the mathematical demonstrations that the ENIAC ran were entirely programmed and put on the machine by these women, none were mentioned in the press. In some historical images, even in US Army historical images, they are cropped out or captioned as models, which is so deeply offensive. So I'm going to introduce them to you now, for the sake of rectifying history: Kathleen McNulty, Betty Jean Jennings, Elizabeth Snyder, Marilyn Weskoff, Frances Beulis, and Ruth Lichterman, six of the first ever computer programmers. Yes. And although that moniker, ENIAC 6, was used to obscure their efforts, I will say that it would be a really amazing name for an all-girl punk band. So please, someone take that and run with it. At the time that the ENIAC 6 were working, though, it's important to remember that software was not like an off-the-shelf product. It wasn't even a word. Neither was programmer. These women, what they did, they were either referred to as operators, like a telephone operator, or coders sometimes. And there was no clear definition of what the job was or anything. In fact, one of the ENIAC 6, Betty Snyder, truly one of the greats in the history of computer science, she called their job being a cross between an architect and a construction engineer. Well, that's pretty much what programming is like today, still. But it was through their work, defining what this role meant, coming up with the standards for how we approach these problems, during and after the war, that programming actually became something that was separate from sort of the menial manipulation of hardware. It became its own thing. It became an art form. It became a language. After the war, Grace Hopper, Betty Snyder, and several of the ENIAC 6 and many of their peers actually went on to careers in the early commercial computing industry. So because they were the best and only programmers in the world, they went on to jobs like running the entire programming division of the Eckert-Mockley Computer Company, which was the first commercial computer company in the US. They wrote the logical design and the instruction set and debugged and built and maintained the software installations for every single UNIVAC ever made. Now, there's a lot of acronyms in this history, be patient with me, but the UNIVAC in the 50s was equivalent to a computer. I mean, the same way that we say Xerox to mean copy machine and Kleenex to mean tissue, people said UNIVAC to mean computer in the 50s. So this really, really important computer in the history of computing was entirely run on the programming side by teams of talented female programmers. And it was while working on machines like these that women like Grace Hopper and her peers first started to push the art of programming forward. So during the war, as I mentioned, they coded at the machine level, you know, menially manipulating all these patches and cables and thinking about code as just a manually written out series of binary numbers. But after the war, they began to develop this idea of what was then called automatic programming, which is basically just the idea that programmers should be able to step above all this button pushing and start to think about their work in a sort of larger systems level way. And with the help of intermediaries like compilers and generators and assemblers, begin to code at a higher level of abstraction. And this move towards systems level thinking, it pushed the entire industry forward and led to nothing less than the development of programming languages as we know it today. In fact, Grace Hopper was the sort of grandmother of COBOL, one of the earliest shared programming languages, the Common Business Oriented Language. Now, COBOL is nobody's favorite programming language. In fact, it's partially responsible for the Y2K crisis. Although, to be fair, because it lasted that long, it's kind of remarkable. But it did the job. It really did an important job. It opened up computing to an entirely new generation. Because people like Grace Hopper and many of her peers understood sort of inherently that computing could never make it into the next generation if it remained something that was only in the hands of experts, if it remained in this sort of shadowy priesthood of people who knew how to code. Grace wanted to see programming made accessible to a new generation of people, people who weren't necessarily conversant in like the arcane art of flipping individual bits. She knew that it would be necessary to have programming languages that were both machine independent, which means they could run as well on a UNIVAC machine as they ran on an IBM machine, as they ran on a Remington RAND machine, et cetera, and that were written in something close to natural language. So people who, you know, just spoke English but not binary could actually maintain these entire systems. And this idea of interoperability and access, regardless of expertise, is pretty central to the history of women in computing. It comes up again and again, and it's what I want to emphasize today as I move through a few stories in this history. I'm going to introduce you to more women than just Grace Hopper. I mean, she gets a lot of the credit because she really is a giant, but there's a long, long history. And you're going to meet a few women that are really at the front lines of technology throughout their eras and time. Not all of them are super technical. In fact, it was important for me to emphasize the fact that we can all make contributions to tech regardless of our technical aptitudes. We can make contributions as artists, as community builders, as designers, as writers. There's lots of places to get in. I mentioned at the beginning of this talk that the women I discovered or met and spent time with over the course of writing this book felt to me like the seeds of a different future. And I can't tell you how many times I found myself reading about a technology or an approach or application of technology that, had it just been implemented like early enough and at scale with resources, would have fundamentally changed the way that we operate today in our digital mediated world. So these women aren't just role models, they're like glimpses at another possibility, another way of using tech, another way of treating each other online. I want you to keep that in mind as we move through this. Okay, we're into color photography era, don't worry, we're getting through this. This woman is Radia Perlman. In this photo is the 1970s, and she was one of only about 50 women in her class at MIT. In co-ed housing, she was the only woman. I don't know if that really counts as co-ed housing. She didn't fit in at all with like all the future engineers and computer scientists she saw on campus. In fact, she didn't even really like computers. She was a math whiz. And the only time she'd ever taken a programming class was when she was a kid, and she had found herself surrounded by all of these like really whiz kid boys who had been taking radios apart since they were old enough to walk. And she'd never taken a radio apart, even though her name was literally Radia, because she thought she'd get in trouble, or she thought she'd electrocute herself. In her very first computer science course at MIT, her professor returned her very first assignment to her with an angry note, saying that she had done something terribly wrong, she had sent the computer into a loop, and she had wasted reams of paper. At her first job at the legendary AI lab at MIT, she was surrounded by all these male programmers who would sit around her as she was working and do things that were probably intended to be helpful, like tell her every single thing she was doing wrong as she was doing it. And because of that and a lot of other things, Radia, to this day, calls herself a last adopter. She did eventually crack programming, but she gave it up decades ago. So why am I telling you about this woman? Because she's one of the most respected computer scientists in the world. She is a routing protocol designer. So she designs the flow of information and data across entire networks. At the Digital Equipment Corporation, DEC, in the 80s, she was fundamental to the evolution of Ethernet. She quite literally wrote the book on network design. If you take a college level course on network design, you will probably read Radia Perlman's textbook, Interconnections. But do not just take my word for it. Listen to Radia herself.
Without me, some of the designs, some of the alternate designs, if you just blew on the internet, it would fall over and die.
I mean, what an amazing thing to be able to say. Without me, if you just blew on the internet, it would fall over and die. That's confidence, the confidence of greatness. I'm telling you about this because, you know, as a culture, we're fed a lot of myths about what it takes to succeed in tech or to be a good engineer. And that old chestnut about taking radios apart from an early age comes up a lot, again and again. Like, I've even heard in job interviews it's a question that's asked. And that's a really damaging thing because, of course, tinkerers are an asset. You know, tinkerers run the world. But they aren't necessarily able to do what Radia can do, which is step outside of complex systems, view them from a vantage, and determine what needs to be done on a kind of meta level. She can see larger patterns at play in complex systems, and more than that, she designs all of her systems with ease of use in mind because of her early experiences feeling alienated by hardware. She wants to make things and design things that people like her can use, which is just that they work and you don't have to worry about it. It's super damaging to think that only people with a very specific aptitude or approach to technology are worthy of contributing to it, because people like Radia, who don't just think outside of the box, but like hate the box. These are people often that have the conceptual distance that really matters, that is really significant, that allows them to make the really disruptive innovations that sometimes need to be made. And indeed, she has. So that's one lesson. See, tech is not all about coding. It's not just about being a hard-nosed technical person. It's about meaning. It's about people. It's about sensing and understanding where software touches society and designing software that touches society gently, generously. There are a lot of technical women in my book, of course, but there's also artists and game designers, like I said earlier, librarians, community builders. And it was important for me to highlight the many different ways in which people can make contributions to technology, many different ways which are often undervalued, which often fall under the purview of what women tend to be good at. Let me give you another example. This is Stacy Horn. Now, when this photo was taken in the late 80s, as you can tell from the power stance and the turtleneck and the gelled hair, she had just founded an online community. Now, in 1989, an online community didn't mean something on the World Wide Web. It didn't even necessarily mean something on the internet. In her case, they meant a bulletin board system, or a BBS, which is basically like a text window that you call on the phone and paid for by the hour, like a message board. She had been kind of a devotee of this early BBS in the Bay Area called The Well, but she'd always felt really out of step with it because she was a New Yorker, like through and through a New Yorker. And whenever you logged onto The Well in those days in the mid to late 1980s, you came across a lot of kind of cyber hippies and techno-utopian people who were really into the groovy possibilities of the internet. But, you know, she was a super cynical, snarky New Yorker. So when she started her own BBS system, she called it the East Coast Hangout, Echo. And she hosted it not out of a garage in Palo Alto or some tech accelerator in San Francisco, but out of her own apartment in Greenwich Village on a stack of modems surrounded by toy figurines and loose leaf papers and photos of her friends. Now, this ad gives you a sense of the culture of Echo, like very New York, right? Snarky, funny, intellectual, kind of self-loathing. And that was the tone of the place. It's what made it special. But it had something else kind of special about it. And here it is, by the way, the whole system in her apartment. Now, in those days in the late 80s, women made up a vanishingly small percentage of people that were online. It was something between 10 and 15% of people who had access to the internet in any capacity, BBS or otherwise, were women. So it made it really difficult, if you were a woman, to find other women online. Because there were so few of them, the minute you signed on to any early online service with a woman's name of any kind, you would tend to fall into immediate sort of, if not harassment, then, you know, pointed attention and bothersome interaction. And so a lot of women that used the internet in these early days used like anonymous pseudonyms or gender-neutral pseudonyms so that nobody would bother them, made it genuinely hard for women to find one another. Echo was remarkable because in 1989, it had 40% female user base, so a significant percentage more than literally anywhere else on the internet. It made it one of the very first places on the internet that women could feel catered to, safe, hospitable to women. Although Stacy always really resisted the idea that she created Echo as like a safe space because she was a really snarky Gen Xer, she wrote, in 1998, she wrote, "Bite me, I wanted to get more women on Echo to make it better." Not to make it safer for women, to make it better for everybody. Because she understood that diversity isn't like some favor that you do to underrepresented people. It's an asset that serves the entire community at large. And Stacy had those female users because she was the only person that was actually trying to get any. She would recruit people from non-technical spaces. She would go to like parties and art galleries and happenings in New York City and just try to get people to buy a modem and join her service. She made access free to women for an entire year. She hosted technical classes out of her very own apartment. She taught Unix out of her own apartment so that a lack of technical know-how would not be prohibitive to women coming online. She created private spaces on the service where women could talk to each other in the absence of male voyeurs. And if a woman left her service, Stacy would call her on the phone and ask her what happened. It's a remarkable thing. That's her, by the way, teaching, this is kind of interesting, teaching BBS to Charlie Rose, obviously, which is like, not aged well. But her main strategy was the simplest thing of all, and it was baked into the design of the service in the very elemental stages. So back in those days, online communities were moderated by hosts. We don't really see that much anymore, but hosts were essentially people who were like users who were deputized to, you know, moderate conversation and lead things along and make sure people were getting along, kind of like a host at a party. Every single conversation on Echo, of which there were hundreds, always had two hosts, a man and a woman, together, so that when women signed onto the service, they would see themselves represented, both in the culture of the place and in the power structure of the place. And the consequence of that was that women were way less inhibited about jumping into the fray of conversation. They didn't feel like they were going to get drowned out because they were there in numbers. They were there in the power structure. It's a simple thing, like the simplest thing. But it worked. Echo still exists today, and this is actually 100% literally what it looks like. It's one of the oldest continuously operating online communities in the world, and a really fascinating peek into the way things used to be for people like me. And it's totally outside of time, because when the World Wide Web came along in the early 1990s, Stacy didn't have the money to make a website. It was also not a very, necessarily an obvious proposition, because she had paying users. Why would she make a free website? So Echo has remained kind of outside of time. And this, to this day, the only way to get a new account on this service is to actually send away for one in the mail, which I think is incredible. Now, of course, it's a little tiny thing, but Stacy managed to achieve gender parity on an almost entirely male-dominated internet because she cared enough to make it happen. And her community, as tiny as it is, has managed to stay online for all of these years through the most cataclysmic shifts in technology because she has cared enough to keep it so. And that is something that I really want to emphasize. It's like this word from a different parallel future, if you will. We don't hear very much about care in relation to tech anymore. We don't talk about care in relation to tech. If we do, we're talking about caring about things, being passionate about things, investing time and money and resources into the potential of building something insanely great, as Steve Jobs would have said. It means risking stability and sanity to build platforms and change the world, and fine, that's great, move fast and break things, like they say. But what Stacy's legacy represents to me is a totally different kind of caring. It's not caring about, but caring for, you know, caring after, taking care of, caring for a community after those glamorous pitch meetings and after the seed round and after the IPO and long into the tedious workaday realities of what it actually means to run and maintain a service that actually works for people, that actually serves people, that actually develops community. It's a beautiful thing. And I know that Echo can never compete with its inheritors. I mean, mailing away for a new user packet is ludicrous, and the actual interface, I guarantee, is millennial proof. But I still keep coming back to this story because it represents to me this great lost opportunity. I mean, what if the architects of our present-day social media platforms cared in this way? What if they brought those values to the table when they built the technology instead of hurrying to fix things after they were broken? What if that approach, what if that value of respecting and caring for your users was like integral to how we built things instead of being an afterthought? Do you think that I would be standing here telling you about how the internet doesn't feel like my country anymore? I don't think so. And that's the thing, is that if you're looking for women in the history of technology, it really does help to look first where people are cared for. And I hate to sort of be essentialist about gender. I mean, there's nothing necessarily specifically feminine about caring about things, but you know, it's definitely something that is socialized as feminine. And listen, I mean, to look in those places where form gives way to function and where capital gives way to community, those are the places that you will find women making major contributions in this history. And those contributions are so often undervalued and overlooked because they're not seen as important by the standards by which we judge things to be successful in the modern world, right? I mean, we lionize these founders that build huge platforms that exploit us and disenfranchise us and tear apart the fabric of cities and become extremely wealthy in the process. Those are our rock stars. But I think people like Stacy are so much more important to me and so much more representative of what tech can be if we just care enough to make it so. Okay, another example before I get emotional. This is the last person you'll meet tonight. This is my dear friend, Dame Wendy Hall. Dame, she was given the female equivalent of a knighthood for her contributions to computer science. She's British. But back when this photo was taken, this bowl cut, she was a lowly lecturer, which is a professor, at the University of Southampton in the UK. And she was fascinated by this crazy newfangled concept called hypertext. And the hypertext was something that Stacey Horn couldn't afford to put on her service. It's something that we associate with the World Wide Web. We build the World Wide Web in hypertext markup language, HTML. Links on the World Wide Web are hypertext links. But as a discipline, hypertext existed long before the arrival of the World Wide Web, and it's essentially the study and practice of connecting ideas, text, images, multimedia documents, and information together in computer systems using links. Essentially, it's the study of making meaning from the sort of morass of digital information that computer memory makes possible. Now, Wendy Hall had been turned onto hypertext, and I'm gonna get way into the weeds now, and please forgive me. Wendy Hall had been turned onto hypertext by this project from 1986 called the Doomsday Project. It's spelled Domesday because it's Middle English. It's too long of a story to tell you now. But it was a massive project that was funded by the BBC in the mid-80s to essentially create like a time capsule of British life in the 1980s. And so it was, the final product was two digital laser discs, okay, that ran on a custom computer system. And the remarkable thing about the Domesday project was that it contained this hypertext interface. And this is a long time before the World Wide Web. So if you look on the screen on this computer, you see like a picture with pictures and words, and you would think, yes, click on that picture, it'll take me somewhere else. That's kind of natural to the way we navigate information on screens today. This is very, had never happened before this, okay? So before this, you know, you might have pictures, you might have code, but you would not have something that was point and clickable in this way. It's a remarkable thing. Now the discs that the system came with included all kinds of really interesting kind of like human weirdness, like virtual walks through the British countryside and images of somewhat bleak looking British cities and maps and first person accounts from school children all over the country. And all that stuff was really interesting. But what knocked Wendy out about this system was how immediate and intuitive it felt to click through all of these pictures, to click through all of this information and navigate it in this kind of hands-on way. She understood, and she was not a computer science person, she was a mathematician, but she understood that this would make computers accessible to a whole new realm of people. It would make computers intimate, personal, you know, exciting for kids, for everyone who had always thought computers were not for them. So she threw herself into it. She wanted to be part of this movement, this thing called hypertext. It felt revolutionary to her. And again, this thing of democratizing access to technology, which is such a big part of this history. Now, Wendy's colleagues in the computer science department, mathematics department at Southampton, told her she was a lunatic and that there was no future for her in computer science if she kept on with this, that she would be ousted from the department if she kept on with this, because hypertext was seen as this kind of like fluffy, less than thing. It wasn't as serious as writing compilers and programming languages. But she ignored them, obviously. I wouldn't be telling you about this if she didn't. And she dedicated all of her efforts to building a hypertext interface for her university's library archives. And when she was done with that, she built an entire system called Microcosm. Now, just as the World Wide Web would do, just a few years later, Microcosm demonstrated this new and totally intuitive way of navigating information on computer screens. It made that information dynamic, it made it alive, it made it exciting, it made it adaptable to the users. In fact, it wasn't like the web at all because it was a lot better. Now, this is the thing about the World Wide Web, and we live with it now, but on the web, this is the website, on the web, links are what's called contextual, which means that they're embedded in individual documents. The little blue hyperlink link on a web page lives there and it only lives there. It is connected to the page. What that means is that if the destination of the link is changed or goes away for any reason, we get what's called a 404 error, right? That link is said to rot. And it's something that happens so much on the internet. I mean, I think the average lifespan of a website is about 9 years at best. So the web is full of these 404 errors. And for every 404 error on the web, we have lost a little bit of information about what connected two ideas together. And that information is not insignificant. That's metadata. That's information about the nature of the connections between things, which is an essential part of understanding what something means. Meaning comes from those kinds of connections. So, in short, the web, bad. Wendy's system, Microcosm, kept all the links separate in a separate database called a link base, which we're not going to get too far into the weeds on this, but the important thing is that the links in her system communicated with documents without leaving a mark on them. So a link in Microcosm was like an information overlay. It never made any structural change to the material, which meant a lot of things. It meant that you could never have a 404 error. It meant that links could go in more than one direction. They could go one way and then back. It meant that a link could have more than one destination, could go to any number of different places. And it also meant that different users could layer different links over the same material. So an expert would get different links than, you know, a kid. It would be dependent on the user. It meant that the system was built to help people learn. It was built with an understanding of the nature of meaning making. It was built to be adaptable to people. And above all, it valued that super important piece of information, the nature of the connections between things. It's what makes us human, good. And there were a lot of hypertext systems like this around the time that Wendy was working in the sort of mid to late 80s, coming out of universities and research labs at Apple and IBM and Xerox and Sun and Symbolics, and they don't look like much, I know, but they were really important. And nearly every major team building these systems in the mid-80s had women in senior positions, if not at the helm. There's lots of reasons for that. I think primarily hypertext as a discipline was just more inviting to people from different backgrounds. It wasn't like hard-nosed computer science people only. It was people who were interested in the nature and meaning of connections between things. So if you went to an early hypertext conference in 1989 or 1991, you would come across, you know, social scientists, humanists, historians, poets, like the literati were in the mix because it was something that was interesting to a lot of people outside of specifically computer science. And I could go on, and I will spare you my thoughts on how cool all these systems are, but what they really had in common was that they valued that really important piece, that piece about connection, the nature of connection, why things were connected. To hypertext's small but committed community of female scholars, that was the nature of the beast. That was what it was all about, because from why emerges the deepest form of meaning. In fact, it was so much what hypertext was all about that when Sir Tim Berners-Lee, first presented the World Wide Web as we know it today at the Hypertext 1991 conference in San Antonio, the very first presentation of the web to anyone in the US, people thought it was like the most juvenile thing. In fact, his paper wasn't even accepted to the conference. He had to lug his $10,000 NextCube computer all the way from his research physics lab, CERN, all the way to Texas to run a demo on his own dime during the demonstration period of the conference, which most people did not attend. And people looked at the system, you know, hypertext scholars who had spent their entire careers thinking about links and meaning, looked at the system and they thought, well, what good is a hypertext system when the links are gonna break right away? I mean, this is never gonna go. One anecdote about this that I have to tell you is that the demonstration period of the Hypertext 1991 conference was held after all of the presentations and panels and talks of the conference had happened. Everybody was exhausted. You know, nobody wanted to hear any more about computers. It happened to also be held during the cocktail hour. And because it was San Antonio, and because it was summer, the cocktail hour's main feature was a large margarita fountain, okay? And so the very first time that the World Wide Web was being presented to the US, to the community of scholars that he thought would go with it, everybody was just outside getting drunk on margaritas. So much so that if you could see in this picture, in that tiny picture, that's a margarita. Someone wandered in with their drink from outside, they'll be like, you know? And like, look how unimpressed everybody is. It's just remarkable to me. Of course, we all know what happened. Like, you know, within a year of this photo being taken, the web was the worldwide standard. In 1992, so 1 year later, Tim Berners-Lee published the very first image to ever be clicked on in a web browser, which was a photo of four women, a doo-wop band at the research lab that he worked called Les Horribles Cernettes, the Horrible Cernettes. They were all female employees of the CERN research lab who sang like satirical songs about computer science. And this is not super relevant to the history, but I'm just gonna give you like a tiny teaser of what they sounded like.
Ooh, yeah. I fill your screen with hearts and roses. Ooh, la, la, la. I fill your mail file with lovely phrases. They all come back invalid users. You never let me into your computer.
This is like so dear. They're sitting on a massively powerful supercomputer singing about how it's impossible to get a date at CERN because everybody is like too obsessed with their work. You never let me into your computer. How sweet is that? Anyway. So after this, of course, comes everything else, right? The deluge. And by 1994, Tim Berners-Lee was giving the keynote at the Hypertext Conference. And all those more sophisticated systems that really cared about the nature of meaning and more, like Wendy Hall's Microcosm and all the many others, they were, you know, they went the way of the buffalo quite quickly. Now, there's no way for us to know for sure if something like Microcosm or one of its many, you know, peers could have ever replaced the web and solved all the problems of the web by never having broken links, for one. Just as there's no way to know if Echo, had Stacey Horn had enough money to make a website, could have replaced our terrible, terrifying social media platforms of today with something a little bit more equitable and kind. But that doesn't stop me from dreaming about it. And I think it's really important to remember these significant alternatives to what we have, because nothing happens in a vacuum. You know, technologies never just like fall fully formed from the sky. They emerge from a continuum of ideas and people and collaborations. Tech history, as it's often written, is so very often about like solitary, usually male genius. Right? Steve Jobs and Tim Berners-Lee and Bill Gates, Elon Musk, shudder. And of course, all these people are remarkable in their own ways, but they've never been alone. They've always been surrounded by ideas and people and precedent, and of course, lots of women. And the amazing thing about tech is that, you know, making big things has always required big communities of people, but it's also what makes it really difficult to remember where things actually come from, and it makes it hard to imagine where they might have gone. Because when we don't see the multiplicity of all this history, we leave out a huge part of the story, and more importantly, we make it harder for all of those past possibilities to play their magic on the world and influence us and make it better. In the 1960s, women were about half of the workforce in computing, and they earned 40% of computer science degrees at American universities until about 1984. They haven't been as visible, and we can talk about that during the Q&A if you like, because the industry has found many cunning ways to push women out of the picture. You know, there's always been wage disparity, lack of access to childcare, lack of mentorship, and a kind of shift of the professional credentials that are required to get a job as a programmer. Technology historians have suggested that the professionalization of tech is what led to its masculinization. And this seems to have set like a male dominant precedent or assumption that's only reinforced itself over the years through misconception and marketing images like these, which were extremely prevalent throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Images that reinforce in an implicit way that the role of the computer and the role of the user are it's man and computer hand in hand together while the woman watches on from the kitchen sink. These kinds of images make us feel like men are natural to computing, but they're not necessarily. And you know, let me say that again, they're not. And many of us here are proof, no doubt. So if you remember nothing else from this talk, like none of this stuff about hypertext and BBS systems and all the deep nerdy arcana of this history, please remember that if there is a boys club that dominates tech today, dominates Silicon Valley, it is like a flaming anachronism. It is an unusual blip in the history. Like, it's really a deviation from the norm. These photos were taken by an operations manager at a Bell Labs data center in 1970, which was at the time developing a state-of-the-art database search system. Look at these women. Look how fabulous they look. This was normal. This was every tech workplace until the early 1980s, essentially. Now, machines can now perform in fractions of a second the work that took dedicated groups of human computers many, many girl years to complete. But it's also important to remember that for a lot of time, for many centuries in fact, women working together were the hardware. They were the network. These sort of distributed biological machines capable of calculations greater than any single individual. Calculations that charted the stars, that measured the world, that built the bomb. And the computer as we know it today is named after the people it replaced, the women it replaced. And before we came to rely on the network as a fact of daily life, our great-grandmothers were performing the functions that brought it about. It took a generation to create the sort of male-dominated tech environment that we live in today, and I think it's probably gonna take another generation to undo it, to say nothing of breaking it open way, way further. But I think that in a technological world, technological histories are important. And if women and girls are to see themselves in the future of our planet's most profoundly transformative technologies, then it's gonna help if they can see themselves in its past. And I don't know anything about the future. And people always ask me, like, what's next? How do we fix this? History is my bag. But I do know one thing for sure about the future, and that is that if we're going to survive it, we are gonna need all the help we can get. Thank you. Thank you so much, that's so kind. I think we have time for a Q&A. I think I went a little long, but I'm happy to answer any questions you may have that are within my knowledge to answer. And if not, we can just talk afterwards. You don't have to be on the spot. Well, that's amazing. Well, welcome to an exciting, daunting, strange, weird, terrifying, very difficult, but also very rewarding career path. We're in a good moment right now. There's lots of like free coding academies online. There's General Assembly, which teaches coding classes in lots of major cities. I don't know if they have one here, but there's classes. There is? Okay, great. There's classes everywhere. You can teach yourself. I mean, the great thing about coding in general is that you really can teach yourself. There's lots of resources available. And there's lots of communities of peers that are willing to go through that journey with you as they also learn online. That being said, I think, and I said this a couple times already, but you don't just have to be a coder. If you know, like, that's not the only way to get in. It's an important piece, of course, if you want to build things, but there are so many other ways of engaging with the tech if you find that that's not for you, you know? Like, you can be a user interface designer, you could be a communicator, you could be a writer, you can be, you could work at a software company and work to instill the values that are important to building good tools. You can, there's really lots of approaches. So I think if you're interested in tech, you don't have to just become a coder, you can do a lot of things. I mean, I think one of the things that was really driven home for me when I was writing this book, and I think it's fairly obvious to us all at this point, is that when monocultural groups design world-changing technologies, the possibility of, you know, rebuilding the way cities work, the way transportation works, the way education works, the way we organize ourselves in society, the potential for mistakes being made is quite high, you know, and people, but that's why we have the problems we have with harassment on social media now, is because most of our social media platforms were designed by people who never had to think about harassment, never had to think about hate speech, never had to think about being trolled or stalked or doxxed. Those safeguards are not put in place because that's not something that is central to the lived experience of, like, your average, like, 22-year-old white guy. So it's really important when we're building tools to make sure that we have lots of different folks at the table who can think about how those tools might be applied. AI is extra scary because there's the application of AI in policing, the application of AI in immigration, the kind of social credit systems that we're beginning to see in China, the way that it can touch society and damage society by reinforcing negative biases that have been in the data sets since time immemorial is really super scary. So yeah, there is not as much diversity in AI as I would like to see, but I think there are lots of opportunities, and there are also lots of really interesting people, fascinating people holding truth to power. There's a group called the AI Now Institute in New York that's run by women, actually, who are, you know, drilling down on the issues of AI ethics and who are, you know, doing incredible work sort of charting the invisible biases that are inherent in a lot of AI systems that are being applied especially to policing. So there's lots of opportunities to get in, and it's early enough now, I think, that we can sort of make a stink and make sure that these systems are implemented in an equitable way. But, you know, like all technologies, there's the good and the bad. There's always going to be nefarious applications or even just ignorant applications of tech. I think we have this tendency as a society to think that tech is like, that there can be technological solutions to social problems. That's sort of like what's led us so deeply astray, I think, in this day and age. There are never technological solutions to social problems, and AI is the least, like, the scariest way of that I'm seeing that kind of play out. But you know, we bring our baggage with us into everything that we design, and so it's really important to, like, minimize that baggage as much as possible and to really think about the implications, which are sometimes quite difficult to consider when you're in the sort of honeymoon period of designing a new technology. So yeah, there's not really a ton of good news there, but the AI Now Institute, look them up, they're amazing. Well, I think that a lot of the problems that we're dealing with now are not so much a consequence of, like, men taking over, but, like, a consequence of capitalism and scale, right? So when we try to build something that works for billions of people, there's always going to be, it's just gonna be impossible for any moderation to happen that doesn't, like, outsource all the pain and suffering of humanity to some, like, contract laborers who are being traumatized. Like, with a small community online, there's the possibility for individual members of that community to be stakeholders, to work together to sort of build and determine what the rules of engagement are in that community, to, like, to expulse people who are problematic or are abusive. You know, there's this sense of, like, placemaking that is, like, central to all human communities. But when you're looking at something that is, like, so opaque and so massive, it's impossible for any of us to have any kind of emotional stake in what's going on. We have, you know, we can report harassment and abuse all we want on these platforms. It's not gonna make it any more personal to us. It's not gonna make it so that we have any real agency or control over our immediate environment. So I think, and that's also just a consequence of, like, people trying to make money off of community. You know, I think we're still kind of operating under this assumption that the internet is, like, a community technology, you know, because that was such a big part of the ideology of tech, and especially at the beginning of the World Wide Web. And, like, all the social media platforms have kind of grafted themselves onto that assumption and sold us this idea of connectivity that is not at all the nature of what they're trying to do, right? They're really it's actually like a commercial technology, a capitalistic technology that's trying to monetize connections between people rather than nurture them. So a lot of it's like scale and money. And I think where I see alternatives to that are smaller scale things, private spaces. I'm really interested in private spaces online. They've always been there in some capacity, but like the real discourse isn't happening like out in the screaming agora with millions of people watching. It's happening in like the group DMs. It's happening in the Slack channel. It's happening over email. It's happening in small news groups. It's happening in small communities. And that I think is like the nature of human community online is these kind of pocket, interconnected pockets of smaller groups that are sort of like vested and care for each other. You know, obviously that's not like the tide of where social media is going now, but I think it's a tendency that's like worth investigating and nurturing as much as possible. I mean, it's why Facebook does groups, has like doubled down so much on groups, because people express themselves more truthfully and more authentically when they're with a smaller group of people. It's too scary to express yourself with the idea that maybe everyone in the world might see what you're saying, you know? That's not how human beings were wired to be, I don't think. I don't think that like we can live in a world very equitably where like an individual tweet could like go as viral as like the Pope or, you know, like it's just ludicrous. So yeah, I think we need to reimagine what it means to have community. I think we need to divest ourselves from this notion that it has to be something that spans the globe. I think that's just never gonna work. Thanks for having me.